Welcome to Going Beyond Medicine with Elaine Grohman. Conversations with people who are working to make a difference in our world. Now here's your host for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Grohman on Empower Radio, and the show is called Going Beyond Medicine. And as always, I have the great pleasure of introducing to the listening audience individuals who are doing things to make a difference, truly make a difference in the world. And there are so many ways that I bump into people, literally, and that is how this happened with meeting my guest, Nicole Hill. Nicole is a remarkable woman who has done a lot in her life. She has had a lot of challenges, but is always working to overcome those challenges. And rather than me explain all of those things, I'm going to introduce Nicole. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
So it was quite interesting in August when I was teaching a workshop, and there was this big gathering going on in the hallway across from me. And it just happened that I ran into the right person, you, in the hallway. And I said, can you please tell me what this is all about? So, and you had a t-shirt on that said Poor People's Campaign, which caught my attention right away. So please tell us a little bit about you, Nicole, and what you do and how we need to change things in the world, if you will, please.
Okay. Well, I joined the Poor People's Campaign, which is actually called the Poor People's Campaign, a call for moral revival. And the reason it's called that is because of the moral climate that's going on in our country today with President Trump in office and just the entire administration and what they're doing to this country, and of course, most importantly, the blatant attack on the poor people of this country, which there are 140 million people who are living at or below the poverty line in this country that are vilified for being poor.
Yes.
And I'm one of them.
Now, Nicole, you had said that you were originally displaced because of Hurricane Katrina. Is that correct?
Yes, I was.
And so you came to Michigan as a result of that. And people, that's just having your whole life uprooted like that is just so, and the trauma of it all is hard to even imagine, of course. But then coming with all of your children, and you're the mother of seven children, you said.
Yes, I am. I have seven in total.
Bless you.
Four are now adults, and I have three that are still at home.
Mm-hmm. So what happened that you had to, obviously, Katrina, was your home lost in the hurricane?
My home was lost in the hurricane, basically everything we owned. When we were rescued, it was just that. That's what was rescued. We were rescued.
Oh, my gosh.
We didn't have anything else. Everything that I had worked to build, family memories, sentimental items, everything was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was enough of a trauma, but then the trauma continued the way they treated a lot of the victims of Katrina afterwards.
Tell us about that, please, because I don't think anyone has any idea what it is like to go through such a challenge.
Well, first of all, to go through that, you find out exactly that racism is still alive and well in this country.
Yes.
There were very mismanaged things going on with, like, the rescue mission. There were people who were attacked by police officers that were trying to escape just everything that was going on down there. And they were attacked basically for being people of color. And
What parish were you in, Nicole?
I was in Renard Parish.
Renard Parish, okay.
Yes. and just trying to survive down there. There, of course, everybody was displaced as well, so the sheltering areas contained various varieties of people,
correct,
which may not necessarily be conducive to someone who has small children.
That's right. That's right.
So that was a lot of the trauma, just living through that situation. And then watching the mismanagement of funding through FEMA and Homeland Security, I personally witnessed people that I knew were not displaced. They were actually down there to be part of the rescue mission, sign up and receive funding, when there were people who have actually been displaced, mm-hmm, such as myself, who have never received funding because there was so much fraud that was discovered going on with the FEMA checks and receiving funding that there are people who actually needed it that didn't receive it.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And then you were eventually, how did you eventually get to Michigan?
They sent a large portion of people got sent to Texas, and then they said that there was severe weather coming that direction as well, and the Red Cross started trying to further displace people. And they started asking people, you know, where they wanted to go, because they tried to place people where I guess they felt they could recover and function. And I had had family here. I had stayed here before, and I said, well, I'll go to Michigan because I figured I would have the best opportunity to recover there, and I knew my way around, and I felt that I would be able to secure, you know, gainful employment when I got here.
Yes. And then, and when was that that you actually came to Michigan?
I came up here, it was mid-September of 2005.
So since then, obviously, you were in the midst of all of this, what we hope, and obviously you've lived through the understanding that everything doesn't work smoothly, especially when there's a huge disasters.
Absolutely.
And you were brought to Texas by the Red Cross or by another agency or through FEMA? Or how did you physically get from Louisiana, New Orleans, to Texas, and then from Texas to Detroit?
They bust us.
They bust you.
Yes.
Okay. You and your children and whatever belongings you could have.
Well, just, yeah, that was it, me and my children, basically.
Okay. Okay. So when you came to Michigan, how were you getting, did you get settled in with family? Did you get settled in with?
Initially, when I got here, I had family here. And prior to contacting them, we were placed in a shelter. And because I had children that were small, they tried to place me in, I guess, a domestic violence shelter, because they felt that that would be a little safer because it's just women and children there only.
Yes.
And I started making contact with my family, and then I got put out of the shelter because they had some domestic violence cases they were actually going on, and since that was the type of shelter it was, they took precedent.
Yes.
So they had to provide space for someone who was coming in from a domestic situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of went from shelter to shelter, and I hoped that family would help, but I wasn't really receiving any beneficial help from my family. I was receiving more suggestions versus come stay at my house, you know, we're going to work to help you get on your feet, things of that nature. It was more so like, contact this agency, call here, you know, see if this can help you. And that's the type of assistance that I ended up getting, which was very shocking to me because growing up, my mother and myself and our immediate family was always very helpful in assisting other family members. So
that it wasn't reciprocal was shocking, obviously.
It was very shocking, especially considering the circumstances.
Yes.
It was very shocking.
Right. It's not like you just were, you know, not wanting to do something. You were obviously in a very dire situation.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. My God.
And eventually I located a housing program that helped me get placed into a home in the city of Detroit.
And is that where you are currently, or?
Well, I'm in a different home at this time, but that was initially the first home that I got placed in.
Okay.
And I got placed in the home, and I started, you know, looking for a job and trying to get just basic necessities back again, clothing, you know, things that get our paperwork reset and make sure that I had proper documentation, you know, to do the things that I needed to do for my family.
Just the logistical nightmare of just getting birth certificates and things like that. If everything is destroyed in the flooding, how, I can't even imagine, was there people helping you to do this, or was this something that you had to do on your own?
Some of it I had to do on my own, and some of it I did get assistance.
Okay. So please continue. What happened once you got settled in Detroit? You were in the...
I started working. I found a job at, which is now Macy's. At that time, it was Marshall Fields,
mm-hmm.
and they were in the process of changing over, and I started working, and throughout all of this time, there began to be a lot of stress going on, of course, in my family through all of this. But my husband experienced quite a bit of stress, and then it didn't help that when we arrived, we had to separate because they didn't have, he couldn't stay at a domestic violence shelter.
Right, right.
And once we got into a house, the stress continued, and it was discovered for me that he had a had developed a substance abuse problem. And I was working and he wasn't, and that added fuel to the fire. And I tried to be supportive and, you know, suggest that he get help, and he refused, and it resulted in us getting divorced. So now I was a single parent trying to work and take care of three children at the time, and I then discovered that I was pregnant again.
Oh, my.
And with my youngest child, who's now 12. So I was working, and I still didn't have a vehicle, and I still didn't have a lot of money, and things were really difficult, and I continued to work in a large portion. I was realizing, like, I should be able to make it. I was making a decent wage. It wasn't the best, but I realized that a large portion of my earnings went to childcare.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this wasn't even all day childcare. Mind you, my children were only in childcare half a day because they were in school the other part of the day.
Right.
And I continued to work, and I thought I was, you know, starting to recover and, you know, following the quote-unquote American dream, working hard, you'll get somewhere. And our supervisors came in one day and said, well, you know, we are being bought out by Macy's. And everybody, all the employees thought that was just awesome because, you know, Macy's, you always hear about the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and they're this big posh, you know, department store you hear about in New York City. And so we thought this would be awesome. It would be better for us. Maybe now we would get benefits as well. And they said, well, we're probably not going to keep everybody on, but our, you know, employees that have been here for an extended time will probably be secured a position with Macy's. And I thought that my position was pretty integral because I did loss prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of pulled my supervisor to the side. She said, oh, no, I'm not worried about our jobs, you know. And I went away like, okay, I'm sorry for some of these other people, but I'm still happy that I have a job because I have children to take care of and a baby to prepare for. And I continued to work until about, I wanted to say, maybe March of 2006. And my supervisor came to me one day and gave me my pink slip.
Oh, geez.
And they had finalized the plans with Macy's, and Macy's decided that they didn't want to keep any loss prevention from Marshall Fields.
Hmm.
So I was out of a job. And
were you given any severance, or were you just said, here, you're done?
We were given, like, just our last week's pay. That's it. We weren't given any additional severance, any...
No assistance.
We were told, here's your last paycheck, and, you know, if you go somewhere else, we'll be a reference.
Mm.
And eventually, the store that I was working for closed down altogether.
So there was no chance of being in that particular location anyways.
Yeah. And so I was kind of stuck in a bad place because by that time I was far enough along in my pregnancy where the average employee probably would not hire me.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're looking at me and they're going to say, as soon as she gets in and gets to working good, she's going to be off.
Right, right.
So I applied for welfare because that was pretty much my only option at that point, along with unemployment.
Yes.
And I was at home, and I had my daughter, and I had to recover. And luckily, I was not, you know, able to receive welfare benefits because she came early.
Oh, boy.
And I stayed at home and I was taking care of my daughter, and I've just been, it just seems like ever since then, it's been very difficult to fully recover to where I was prior to the hurricane.
Mm.
And I fast forward, things go like normal life, you just try to get through it day by day. I've worked several jobs. None of them adequately enough for me to provide for my family without still qualifying for some type of state benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them don't offer insurance or, you know, medical or dental, retirement, anything like that. And I've watched my children grow up and struggle. they struggle with what I guess normal kids struggle with if their parents may not have what some other kids' parents have. And, you know, that's the normal, like, well, you know, I don't get to get the clothing items that they have, or why don't we have a car, or things like that. But I've managed to try to keep utilities on. I've kept a roof over their head until 2014.
Yes, you're saying something significant happened in May of 2014.
Yes, and in May of 2014, I had been watching on the news that, you know, people's water was getting cut off in the city of Detroit. And, you know, I thought it was horrible, but I never, like, investigated into the circumstances. Because, you know, you see it and you automatically think, well, maybe that person, something happened and they couldn't pay their bill. Or maybe they don't try to pay their bill.
Right.
You know, and at that time I had been paying my bill. And I got up that morning and took my kids to school after breakfast. I came back to wash the breakfast dishes, and I turned on my faucet, and nothing came out. And this wasn't an immediate shock, because at least twice a year in the neighborhood I was staying in, there was a water main break. Mm. And the Department of Water and Sewerage would come out to repair it, and they would not let anyone know, you know, well, the water's going to be off while we're working on this line. They would just turn off the water.
No advance notice given?
So no advance notice given. And usually someone would say, oh, my water's off. And if they were brave enough, they would come out and ask neighbors if theirs was off. Or And some people would say, well, mine is, and others would say, well, mine's running slowly. And someone would drive around the neighborhood, and you would see them working on the water.
Mm.
And you'd go, oh, well, they're working on the water main down the street or around the corner. And everybody would go, oh, okay. You know, they didn't take the consideration to say, we're having a water issue, and it's going to be, your water will be temporarily off for this amount of time while we repair it. You know, please take precautions against that, whether it's filling up your bathtub or anything.
Right.
Because it was not a wealthy, affluent neighborhood, so who cares? And this is honestly my opinion only, that they felt, who cares if these poor people don't have water?
Oh,
even if it's temporary, because since then, I have seen exactly that, and in a matter of words, heard representatives from that department voice that, so that I now believe that's what they think all the time.
Mm.
And so when I discovered my water off, I figured that's what was going on, so I went outside and I asked an elderly neighbor next door to me, and he goes, my water's on. I don't think so. So I said, well, maybe, you know, it's just him. He's at the corner. I'll ask another neighbor further down and see if me. And everyone was saying that their water was on. And I said, well, did you see any water department trucks around? He said, I did see a truck out here, but it wasn't a water department truck, so I didn't, you know, think anything of it. And he said, and he was trying to pronounce the name, and so I asked him to spell it because he was mispronouncing it, and it was a Homrick truck, which the city of Detroit initially hired Homrick to demolish all the homes that they had foreclosed on in the city, in the supposed abandoned homes as well, which through foreclosure they made abandon quite a few of them. And unbeknownst to most people, they had also decided to have them conduct the massive water shutoff campaign that they had bombarded the city with, which they, at the height of the water shutoff, shut off about 7,000 people a week.
A week?
A week.
For how long? For how long of a period of time was this massive shutoff taking place?
They're still doing massive shutoffs in the city of Detroit. They have not stopped.
Oh, my gosh.
They just don't televise it anymore, but they have not stopped. The mayor and the water department has just continued this. Altogether, during the city's bankruptcy, which was around the time that my water got shut off, they had about 75,000 people shut off in the city.
Oh, my gosh. Nicole, we have to take a real quick break, so if you will just stay on the line with us, we'll continue our conversation about
sure.
the challenges that you've had and many people have. Nicole Hill is my guest. Please stay with us. We'll be right back after a quick break. This is Elaine Groman for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio.
Meditation channel, non-stop meditation music 24 hours a day in the new Empower Radio app. Music to empower your meditation, help you relax, sleep, or provide a calm background while you work. The Empower Meditation channel is interruption free. Listen now with the Empower Radio app, free in the App Store, or listen online at empower.fm. Soothe your soul, calm your mind. The Empower Meditation channel.
Packers.
Vikings.
Red State.
Blue State.
We come from different places.
Uptown.
Downtown.
We come to different conclusions.
Half empty.
Half full.
But no matter how different we are, we're all connected, and we can all make a difference. That's why United Way brings people, expertise, and resources together to improve the education, income, and health of our communities. The building blocks for a better life. When we live united, our efforts, magnified by others, add up to real change. Children succeed in school, families gain financial stability, the health of our neighbors improves, and suddenly, so do our communities. But real change won't happen without you.
Live united.
So let's look beyond our differences.
Live united.
One by one, let's make a difference. Let's reach out a hand to one and influence the condition of all.
Live united.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Sign up today at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
I'm Paul George of the Indiana Pacers. When I was six, I had one thing on my mind. When I was six, my days were spent playing basketball every chance I could. When I was six, my dream was to make it to the NBA. When I was six, my mom had a stroke. So I want you to learn the signs of a stroke fast. F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. Because the sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in their recovery. I'm Paul George. Protect the ones you love. Spot a stroke F-A-S-T. Fast. Life is why. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
This message is for all of you sitting in the passenger seat. And apologies if it gets a little uncomfortable. But how does it feel to be at the mercy of someone who thinks a random text is more important than your life? Someone who takes their eyes off the road while speeding along in a 3-ton hunk of steel. Freaky, right? Well, why not just ask them to stop? Or better yet, volunteer to text for them. It might be a little awkward, but believe me, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Empowering you for a better life.
This is
Empower Radio.
Now back to Elaine Groman and Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Welcome back to the show. This is Elaine Groman, and my guest today is Nicole Hill, a mother of seven who has had to do virtually the impossible. She has survived the Hurricane Katrina, was relocated several times, eventually landed in Michigan, and we're picking up back with our conversation about the experience that she had in May of 2014, in which her water was cut off in the city of Detroit. Welcome back to the show, Nicole.
Thank you.
Would you mind sharing, continuing with what was happening at that time?
Yes. As I was saying, there was a massive water shutoff campaign going on throughout the city of Detroit. The city at that time was enthralled in the midst of a bankruptcy. And I just want to make one quick point about that.
Please.
When you look at what's going on in Detroit and other primarily poor cities with a majority of people of color, the one thing that is across the board is that they all were given control over to emergency management.
Yes.
And that was the downfall of Detroit. They had placed Kevin Orr as the emergency manager, and he was the one that suggested that the bankruptcy be put in place and that they should do this massive shutoff campaign with the water because they wanted to make the water department a viable asset in the bankruptcy. And that is one of the primary reasons why they conducted this massive shutoff campaign, and also the way they conducted the massive shutoff campaign. Because I clearly understand that if you do not pay your bill, your water will be disconnected. But these were a number of people who were in the midst of trying to pay their bill to the best of their ability with the income they had. Many of these people were disabled. They were seniors. They were working for low wages. They were mothers with children and pregnant. They shut off people who had feeding tubes, and it was a necessity that they had water in their homes to properly sterilize and clean things. They did this with all of this with no regard for their own bylaws that say that they're supposed to verify who's in the home. They have just done away with their own, you know, rules and regulations, whatever it takes to accomplish that goal of massively shedding off people is what they did.
And in what you had sent to me, you said that your water bill was escalating over $5,000?
Yes. And the thing is that initially when I started seeing a spike in my water bill, I immediately contacted the water department and said, something's not right. I've just ran through the gamut of issues that I've had. I had two account numbers at one time. They couldn't explain to me why I had two account numbers. I was being billed at an address that I had moved from and was told that when I move, I needed to have a zero balance in order to transfer my water, and that my landlord that I was moving to had to fill out an affidavit within a week verifying that I was to be responsible for the water. All of this was done, and I specifically questioned the department as to what would happen at the previous address that I had moved from. I said, well, is the water going to be turned off? And they said, well, no, it's a rental property. So what we do is we remove your name from that account, and it reverts back to the property owner.
Mm.
I assumed they knew what they were talking about because I surely didn't know the inner workings
of
how the department worked.
Of course.
And so I went, you know, through my monthly ritual of paying my bills. I'm not going to sit here and say that I paid my bill in its entirety all the time because there were months where I just couldn't because my water rates just kept going up.
Mm-hmm.
But I would pay the vast majority of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was discovered when, after I went through several agencies and contacted Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, that in a two-year span, when they were saying that my bill was $5,000, well, let me back up, first of all. It initially started out as three, and that was the day that my water was cut off. It was somewhere around $3,100. And I immediately got up, and I had got my youngest daughter at the time that was only in school half a day, and I walked to the nearest DHS department. And I spoke to a worker, and I told her what was going on, and she called the department, and literally between the time that I arrived there and the time that I had spoken to the department and discovered my water was indeed disconnected for supposed non-payment, my bill had escalated another $2,000 to become this $5,000 water bill.
In a day?
In less than a day. I would say maybe some roughly around 45 minutes or an hour.
So there is no one at this organization, at the water department, that's not scrutinizing these bills and saying, how is this even possible mathematically?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the thing is that I'm not going to vilify everyone at the water department.
Yes, I understand.
There are representatives that do their job.
Of course.
Because that's how I discovered that I had been billed for 2 years at an address that I had not lived at.
You know, Nicole, I just want to say, your grace and the way in which you have dealt with this is remarkable. You are to be commended for the integrity with which you walk in your life. And I thank you for that.
Thank you. As I was saying, the department as a whole is not committing these atrocities towards people.
No, of course not.
It's primarily the upper management, because many of these representatives, they're just doing what all of us are doing. They're working and they're trying to make it through the day.
That's right.
You know. So when I went to the Department of Human Services, I just was sitting there listening to her discuss with the water department to try to give me a voucher for state emergency relief. And she's telling me, like, we pay $175. And I immediately was thinking, like, that's not going to do anything. But, you know, if it gets my water cut back on, it'll give me an opportunity to figure out what's going on, you know, and get this straightened out.
Mm-hmm.
And when they told her it was $5,000, of course, understandably, she looked at me like, I didn't know what I was saying.
I can't even imagine anyone assuming that a single household could use that volume of water. I mean, you would think that might be a number from industry or something like that, but not from a residence. And Nicole, I apologize to kind of speed you along, but since our time is limited, would you please begin to speak about the Poor People's Campaign, A Call for Moral Revival, that you're so involved with right now. And I please accept my apology for having to cut
off what
you're talking about. But I just really want people to understand what you're working on now and how important it is.
Yes. Well, the way I got involved in the Poor People's Campaign is through other organizations that I began working with due to the water crisis that is going on in the city of Detroit. And it's led by Reverend William Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris. And what they are saying is that this is a revival of what Dr. King started. Dr. King initially had the Poor People's Campaign with the evils of capitalism, militarism, and systemic racism. And we've added the war economy and ecological devastation.
Mm.
And the reason these are so important is because this is, we're in a climate now where this is even more important than it was 10 or 15 years ago, which we all know realistically that systemic racism has not stopped. It may have changed his outfit as to how he appears to people, but it's still been going on. And all of these evils have still been going on, and we feel that this is primarily because the moral compass of this country is headed in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're calling for a national call for a moral revival. And one of the biggest things that we've did thus far is beginning May 14th through the summer solstice, we had 40 days of action. And what we did with this action was to bring awareness to what was going on, to let people see, like, this is actually what's happening. And what we did is each week we did several actions. We had what is known as nonviolent moral fusion direct action or civil disobedience. We prefer to call it the other.
Mm-hmm.
And each week we went to Lansing and performed rallies and protest marches, and we had people who were riskers that risked these acts of moral fusion, direct action. And each week was a different theme. And we did this for 40 days, and it was with 40 states across this country. So we had the vast majority of the United States involved, and this was all done simultaneously.
Wonderful.
So
the same event was replicated in 40 different locations?
Well, each state, I think, decided what their action was going to be,
mm-hmm.
but the same theme was focused across the country. Like the first week was women, children, and people with disabilities in the LGBTQIA community.
Okay.
And we went and we did our rally, and we had a protest march, and we marched to the Capitol from a centralized gathering location. And then the action that week was to block the street in front of the Capitol.
Which we did. Can I ask, Nicole, were you getting any support from people that are, or organizations rather, that are helping perhaps disabled people or LGBT people, individuals, or, you know, organizations that are working with helping with women and children? Were there other supporting mechanisms, or was it just the Poor People's Campaign exclusively and their members?
No, actually, there are several organizations that not only fit the profile of the theme of that week, but just are social justice organizations in general that all came and supported in the Poor People's Campaign. We had organizations like D15, which is fighting for the $15 an hour.
Mm.
We've had a tremendous amount of clergy involved. We've had the UAW, we had the Nurses Federation, we have the People's Water Board Coalition, which is an organization in Detroit that fights for water justice. We have Michigan Welfare Rights Organization.
Mm.
There's several different organizations that have come together and said, you know, what this Poor People's Campaign is doing is vital, and we want to be a part of it.
Yes, and as I'm looking at this, what you showed or sent to me, that each week, so you, as you just mentioned, women, children, people with disabilities and LGBT community. Week two, you were working with systemic racism and voting rights, immigration, etc. Mistreatment of indigenous peoples. Week three focused on war economy with militarization and proliferation of gun violence. Week four, the right was the right to health and healthy planet, ecological, obviously, the devastation of the of our living planet. Week five, everyone's right to live, education, living wage, income, and housing. And week six, a new unsettling force confronting the distorted moral narrative.
Yeah.
This is, what a big agenda, but bless you.
But it was awesome to be a part of.
I can imagine.
And see that, not only that, but to realize that despite all of these evils existing, there are a lot of people that are willing to fight for these rights that people have and against these evils, because each week we were growing.
Yes.
And it got to the point where we even got some of people that you would think would be our antagonists, which were the state police, because, of course, they were the ones that were there guarding, you know, the state capitol. And it even got to the point where some of them were kind of like rooting for us.
They were helpful.
You know, I think we had more issues out of local authorities at buildings that we protested in front of. Like one week we protested at the Department of Health and Human Services, and the security there was more hurtful and mistreatful than the state police were.
Well, I think, unfortunately, what happens, and whenever there is any kind of gathering like that, people's fear is initiated. I mean, it's just triggered. You know,
absolutely.
So people that are in the positions of being given the responsibility to be protective, their adrenaline is running. And we have to change the narrative of how do we come together, because everybody is alive. Everybody needs these resources. Everybody needs clean water, clean air, clean access to healthy food, access to housing. We need to change the narrative of how we approach one another.
Absolutely. Instead of looking at a person as lesser than you, I think that it's very important to realize that anyone could get into this position where they are not able to afford or able to have access to the things that they need.
That's right.
And, you know, I made that kind of a point. I was kind of like, you know, I guess what they would call a hype person, because I was the one that was, you know, just saying things because I was trying to, of course, lighten the mood because it was somber at some point. So I tried to use my comedic talent to lighten the mood. And I remember telling some state troopers when they were just kind of standing there, you know, being very, you know, tough upper lip, that, you know, like, we understand you have a job to do, but, you know, I think it was a week where we were speaking, of course, on poverty. And I said, well, you know, people in blue can live in poverty, too.
That's right. And they often do. They often do.
It's just people, and I understand that there's a lot of people who are in poverty that won't speak out about it, because you don't want everyone to know that you're struggling, especially if you feel that there's no one out there that's going to help you. They're just going to vilify you.
Yes.
You know, I understand that personally, because, you know, I've had people tell me, oh, well, you're just not trying hard enough, or maybe you should further your education. And I even, you know, looked at myself and said, well, maybe they're right. So I did go back to school.
Yes, you have two degrees, as I recall reading.
But yet I don't have a job at the moment,
Well, and if education were more attainable because of the financial obligation, and if the jobs that we're being trained for were actually in existence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I find that to be a tremendous problem with a lot of college students that are standing with bachelor's degrees, and they're working at fast food restaurants.
And they have in excess of $100,000 worth of student loan debt.
Absolutely, and they're working. My son went to college, and he works three jobs mm-hmm. to try to pay back student loan debt, not to survive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so I see it firsthand what's going on, and it just angers me. But I also realize that even in my anger, is that some of these people are so disconnected from anyone who's not in that elite group that they just don't see what's going on.
Yes. Again, you my know. Guest is Nicole Hill, and she is speaking on behalf right now of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Nicole, if people in the listening audience want to get involved, how might they able to be able to reach out to you or to any, because this is a global radio station, but obviously are there chapters in every state, or how might someone get in touch with you?
There
please?
Are chapters in every state that we have involved, which is about 40.
Okay.
And you can also go to Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival.org, and you can sign up for the Poor People's Campaign. If you're in Michigan, you can go to MichiganPPC.org and sign up for the Michigan Poor People's Campaign. And if they don't have a chapter where they are and they want to start one, they can contact me. You have my email. They can contact
if you
me
would,
as well.
Okay, so you would want them to contact me, or can they contact you directly?
They can contact me directly.
Then if you would just say what your email is, if you don't
my
mind.
My email is lasharon.laster@gmail.com.
Okay.
That's L-A-S as in Sam, H-A-R-O-N, LASTER@gmail.com.
Thank you. Thank you. So can you tell us what is happening right now, Nicole, so that people, if there's anything in their area or if there's people that want to help, more than just having more people come to the fore and be angry, we also need people that can help to maybe change some of these systems, begin to make
yes.
things work collaboratively so that we can finally have some peace in our world. We need
well,
that.
There's ways that everybody can help. We need, of course, people to sign up and commit to working with the Poor People's Campaign. We take financial donations as well. And also what we're working on now, which is considered phase two, is we've been working on voter suppression and making sure that people understand what the moral narrative is and that they're being registered to vote, and making sure that they come out and actually vote for these issues that we're dealing with to change our political system so that we have people, regardless of party, that are in there that are fighting against these evils. And we also have a hearing coming up later this week in front of Congress, which I have to speak at. So,
and what is that hearing about specifically?
We're speaking about the issues of poverty and how it is causing families to be separated.
Yes.
Especially with all this going on with immigration. And just to touch lightly on that, even though it's not a light issue, is that I want people to know that it's not just Latinx and Middle Eastern people that this is happening to, which I didn't even know myself. I discovered through a meeting last week that the African immigrant community is being targeted as well. People from Sierra Leone and Mali and Senegal, they're being targeted as well by ICE. And I was shocked because not many of them have spoken out about it yet. Mm-hmm. But it is occurring, and we had a representative from that community that spoke out on it.
Mm. Nicole, I want to thank you so much for what you're doing. And I would want to remind people they could go to www.michiganppc.org, which is a Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. There is so much that needs to happen. But one, and I would like to personally stay in contact with you if I have your permission to do so.
Sure.
Because I think this is an ongoing situation that we really need to look at, but we have to have cool and level heads. Because as Native American people, we always speak about how do we look into the next seven generations? We can't just think about now. We have to think about the future. Your children, my grandchildren, your grandchildren.
Absolutely.
All of those people that have a right to be here, and how we can change this and be peaceful in doing so that we can have a better world for us all.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Nicole, for all that you're doing. And again, if you don't mind me, or if you don't mind giving your email address, if people want to speak with you directly.
Yes. It's lasharon.laster@gmail.com.
Okay.
That's lasharon.laster@gmail.com.
Thank you. Is there anything last things you'd like to say?
I would just like to end on saying that one of our mottos, because music is and art is very important to the campaign, mm-hmm. is that we're taking steps forward, not no steps back, and we're a new unsettling force, and we're unstoppable.
Mm. And you know, when we do it with open hearts, and we do it with the understanding that we will never accomplish anything with anger, we will never accomplish anything with fighting, we will only accomplish something when we look at the reality of it and change it.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So thank you so much for your time today, Nicole. Again, my guest has been Nicole Hill, who is working with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Thank you for your time. Thank you for what you do. This is Elaine Grohman for Going Beyond Medicine on Empower Radio. You too can make a difference. Anything that you do to make this world a better place will never be a waste of your time. Thank you so much.